rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a-plowing through the rugged skies, and up a cloudy draw. Yippee-yay! Yippee-yay-o!
Welcome to Pod Stallions, the podcast of PlaidStallions.com. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Hi, everybody.
And today we are going to do a special show in the light of the sad news this week that Sir Christopher Lee, possibly one of the most storied actors in our time, has passed away.
And, yes, at the ripe old age of 93.
93 years old, active to the very end. A fabulous talent. And if you like pop culture, horror, science fiction, heavy metal, Christopher Lee probably touched you or you have crossed paths.
He dropped into your world whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, somehow he must have. And, you know, it's one of those stories and one of those careers and, you know, because in light of his age, that you can say, we're going to miss him, and it is sad that he's gone, but you go, what was left for him to do? Like, he truly ticked all the boxes, and we will go through every box in this episode.
I was saying to somebody the other day, it'll take the rest of my lifetime to see everything he was in.
I mean, he did, what was it, like over 120-some movies, I think?
I think he has a Guinness World Record IMDb. Now, you know, there's been so much trivia thrown at me in the last week about him that, you know, I don't even know. Like, I think he once shot a man for snoring too loud, you know. There was just so much.
That is true.
Some of it, I'm sure, is apocryphal, but I think most of it is true. We can't cover all that. I think we just want to cover our little corner and try and do it well. So
yeah, absolutely. I think the best way to start probably would be as kids when we think our first encounter was with Christopher Lee, right? Wouldn't that be the best way to?
Yeah, and I think mine's probably not normal.
Okay.
Because, you know, No, that's true. But I think a lot of people would say, oh, I saw him as Dracula or Frankenstein or the Mummy. You know, he sure as heck made a lot of horror pictures.
Yes.
And I love him for them. But I think the first time I saw him would have been Space 1999.
Ooh.
And it's probably one of the best episodes. It's called Earthbound. Lee plays an alien named Captain Xantor. IMDb has him as Xandor.
Yes.
The plot of it is you know, the typical cerebral first season. Lee's character is like a space hippie, to be honest with you. He's not a bad guy at all. They're good guys.
So he's kind of a cousin of the crew that were trying to get to Eden in Star Trek.
Sort of, except they're trying to get to Earth.
Gotcha.
And they're from a dying planet, and it's a great episode. It has an O. Henry twist. It's, you know, I would put it in the top two or three episodes they had in that first season of Space 1999.
And isn't that the case, though, with 1999, that it got better as it went on, and And by the, you know, how many seasons? Was it three seasons?
Two seasons.
By the mid second season, didn't it get much better?
No. Depending on who you talk to, they kind of we went into this a little bit before, but they kind of cartoonized the second season.
I know they gave it more action. I didn't know they got cartoony though. No?
A little. They you know, the first season was very trippy and heady. Peter Cushing, by the way, was also in the first season.
Oh, nice. We got to talk about that double act.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But the second season, they kind of... I don't want to discredit it by saying they dumbed it down, but, they added a lot more monsters and punching and... Yeah, something was lost. And, you know, there wasn't quite a... the porridge either got too cold or too hot. And,
they kirked it up.
Yeah, yeah.
They kirked it up. Well, I'm going to say, again, I don't have absolute clarity on this, but I'm going to say it had to be his role as Scaramanga in The Man with the Golden Gun, the James Bond film. Roger Moore's second outing as 007, 1974, Man with the Golden Gun, and he was the... most expensive and greatest assassin in the world. Chip Scaramanga. No, his first name was
The Baltimore Scaramangas.
I'm letting my Bond fandom down here.
You are
Franz Scaramanga? Franz Ferdinand? I forget what his first name is, but I'm going to look it up.
He's listed anyway, on IMDb as just Scaramanga, and I don't know either.
Is it?
Yeah.
I was just going to look it up.
Now that's funny. You know, you and I both... Now, this goes back to toy collecting, but we both picked things that there is a licensed Christopher Lee action figure.
Well, now this is where it gets interesting. Okay, first off, his name is Francisco Scaramanga. So I was close. You're right. So let's go down. Here's what's remarkable about him. And I guess when you start looking at the career that he had and the number of iconic projects, stories, and characters that he played, it probably would be inevitable that action figures were made of him. But let's just go down the list quickly. We'll get back to Scaramanga in a moment because it's such a great character. Well, let's get to Scaramanga real quick. Scaramanga, sure. Was in The Man with the Golden Gun. It was a weird Fleming story. I believe Spy Who Loved Me was written from the perspective of a female character throughout that story. Man with the Golden Gun was one of the last stories I think that Fleming wrote in his lifetime. I'm going to get this completely wrong, but I think it was published in short story form in like Esquire or something like that a number of times before it was collected. It's a wafer thin story, but basically, forgetting all the convoluted bits of the plot and the espionage, Scaramanga plays this assassin. I mean, Christopher Lee plays this assassin called Scaramanga, the man with the golden gun, who gets a hit list. 007 ends up on his hit list, and he has a golden gun, which is made from seven or eight different pieces of ephemera, like a pen, a cigarette case, a lighter, and when you connect them the right way, you've got the golden gun. It's actually made of solid gold. The bullets are gold. I think his signature is on the bullet in some way or something. So he's the world's best known, and no one's ever seen him. That's the thing, is he's so high-end that no one's ever seen a photo. There's no photographs of him. No one's ever seen him, etc. What distinguishes him is that he has a superfluous papilla, which is a third nipple, as Roger Moore says.
That's where they got that whole Krusty the Clown thing, too, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So at one point, Roger Moore disguises himself as Scaramanga to some baddies, and he has Q Branch. His request from Q Branch is for a superfluous papilla. So he has a fake third nipple. You get to see Roger Moore shirtless, the hairless chest of Roger Moore in 1974.
Stark contrast from his predecessor.
Yes, yes, exactly. You couldn't get more different. And you get to see his fake thud nipple in that as well. Now, the really wild, crazy, interesting thing, and this happens a lot throughout Lee's career, the connections that he has. You know, he tells a story during the making of, some of the making ofs in the Lord of the Rings DVDs, that as a student, I want to say Oxford, maybe Cambridge, but as a student, he was in a pub on campus one afternoon, and there was J.R.R. Tolkien in the corner holding court, and he spent the afternoon with some other students getting to talk to Tolkien. So back to Man with the Golden Gun, it turns out that Christopher Lee was, I want to say, second or third cousins to Ian Fleming, creator and author of the Bond character and books. So he had a background with Ian Fleming before he even got the part. Fleming, of course, had passed away by the time he got...
Well, I've also read in the past couple of weeks that Lee, of course, had a career as something of a spy, and something about the ungentlemanly warfare, the League of Ungentlemanly Warfare, or something like that.
Well, I knew about Fleming.
Yeah,
his work with MI6. I think there's a famous book called A Man Called Intrepid.
Yeah. In fact, some of that was done where I live.
Oh, okay.
Camp X. I could bike ride to Camp X.
It was the prequel to A Man Called Sloan.
And I also, yes, it was, because that was so based in fact and reality.
Well, right, the guy with the metal arm. That's true. That's
Torque.
True.
You got it.
Yes. So back, let's just do a quick little sidebar here. I'm making a list as we speak, and I'm checking it twice. Okay, action figures, either action figures or 12-inch figures or 3-inch metal miniature figurines, you name it, of the different characters, it doesn't matter. So far I got Scaramanga from Man with the Golden Gun. The Space 1999 figure, wasn't he just called the Alien?
No, that was the other Alien. Captain Xantor was called Captain Xantor from the planet Kalidor.
Well,
it was really important. I want to add something that yes? Palitoy had the rights to Space 1999 in the UK, and they were notorious for not including female characters. So when it came to Space 1999, they did not make figures of the two other leads of the show. They did not make a Barbara Bain figure, and they did not make a Barry Morse. In fact, instead, they chose to make two lesser, like secondary character, male characters, and then two aliens.
Really?
Yeah, well, I guess...
What was their hang-up with women?
I don't know. They didn't include Uhura in their Star Trek line. The only female character that they brought into the UK from Mego was Zira. There were no female superheroes in their superhero
that is
collection.
Wild. I never knew that. This is Palitoy we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, it seems...
I never knew that.
It seems they had a real... Whoever was in charge of it said,
"Wow,
no chicks, man."
That's crazy, because as we know, chicks always liven up any party.
I gotta understand one thing, because I... tried on many occasions to buy Amigo Supergirl or Batgirl as a kid,
right?
And I
right.
kept chickening out,
right?
So it wasn't for lack of, it just, you know, I there was this thing that held me back. So
right,
I do kind of understand their logic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And yet here's Biff Bang Pow, little toy gun, Biff Bang Pow, getting more attention than ever. With their Amy Poehler and Tina Fey figures all these years later.
Yeah, congratulations.
It's a new universe. Well, no, it's just interesting how people are dying for it. The establishment, the boys, the girls.
Princess Leia changed the world.
She really did.
You know.
All right, so I've got Scaramanga. I got Captain Xantor.
Xantac. There has been, I believe, one licensed 12-inch Dracula produced by Product Enterprises.
Our good pals at the beautiful product from Product Enterprise.
The 2000s were Christopher Lee action figure paradise, because you got Saruman, and then you got Count Dooku
from Star Wars. So we've got Saruman from Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. We got Dooku from Star Wars. We got Dracula by Product Enterprise. So we're going to call that the Hammer Dracula. Yeah. Did I ever tell you? I think I told you once. They did years ago when I became buddies with those guys. They commissioned this great artist to do a lot of the artwork on their packaging. If you go back and look at their stuff, I mean, their remote controlled Daleks.
Oh, those guys can't do much wrong for me.
They did a movie, a Peter Cushing movie, Dalek, with artwork on the packaging of Cushing and the Daleks and spaceships and stuff. All done by this guy whose best known work was doing the half sheet for Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn, which actually shows up in Spaced. It's on the wall in their apartment in Spaced. At one point they do a gallery thing. Product Enterprise puts on a gallery thing for this artist, and a lot of stuff that they'd commissioned, they made into prints, limited edition, like sets of 100 or 50, I forget, numbered signed prints of his artwork that were for sale at this thing. Anyway, I mentioned, gosh, this is how good these guys were. I mentioned, gee, I wish I could get over to London for this gallery thing. I'd love to see it. And 3 weeks later, through the mail, I get a set of like six of these prints, signed prints of this guy's artwork. You know, a beautiful Davros one, a Davros and the Daleks, an Evil Dead one. But my favorite of the bunch is a piece that he did celebrating Hammer Horror. I should take a snap of it and put it on the rundown of the show for you. But it's got Lee's Dracula, it's got Oliver Reed's Werewolf, it's got Cushing, and then right up the middle, all these characters are surrounding. He literally painted a bloody hammer.
Oh,
the actual tool in the middle of the poster. It's got blood coming off of it, and then the characters are around the hammer. It's just so simple. It's kind of genius.
Let's go to the hammer for a second, because it's probably the biggest chunk of this, and I'd hate to get sidetracked, but I mean, for me, when I think of Frankenstein, I'll always think of Boris Karloff.
Sure.
But when I think of Dracula, I think of Lee.
Me too.
He just
isn't that a generational thing, you think, or a taste thing? What do you think that is?
You know, I think that he's just more dynamic. I can barely this. You know, I don't know if I have to turn in my Universal Monster Fan Club card. I doze off during Lugosi Dracula.
It's a classic. It's iconic, but
it's a play.
Yeah,
and it's a little slowly paced. Whereas, the Lee version of it is much more dynamic. It's in color. And to be perfectly honest with you, Lee is a very imposing figure.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, let me tell you, the climax, the freaking violent, loud, scary climax of his first Dracula, and you know what I'm talking about, when Cushing runs across the table and jumps on the tapestry to pull it down off the window.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Lee is exposed to a shaft of light.
Yeah, it's a famous picture. You see that?
It's still incredibly effective, that scene. The whole damn thing. I mean, and we got to remember, I know it's a broken record, but it was in color. The blood was very red in color. So much about that Hammer Dracula was revolutionary and turned, you know, the horror world on its ear. I always got the sense too, from Lee in interviews, print interviews, especially the Lord of the Rings. I mean, he always said he just hopes, during the filming, that he'd always hoped that he could live long enough to finish the Lord of the Rings films. I don't think he understood that there would be three, you know, Hobbit films, but he was saying this back doing the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah, was he in the Hobbit films? I haven't seen those.
He was. He was in all three of them.
Oh wow! Okay.
And technically, he did not. They cut his scene out of the third of Return of the King, the theatrical Return of the King, but he's all over the home version, the extended version. But back then, he was wishing and crossing his fingers that he would live long enough to finish that trilogy.
Well, he was a gigantic fan of that.
Huge, massive Tolkien fan. I think he spoke Elvish. Like, he knew the languages.
I read somewhere, and this could be not true, but he read the books once a year.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Well, that's certainly what he claims.
And I've also heard that he did a terrible Robin Hood series in the 90s because he was playing a wizard. And he just
Robin Hood series in the 90s.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. And New Adventures of Robin Hood, a TV series. This is a beautiful thing about him. Okay, he did a James Bond film in the early 70s, and then he's the bad guy in Captain America 2.
Yes,
he just didn't turn down work, and I find a lot of and the stink of any of the work that he did never got on him because he delivered quality.
That's the thing is you can say what you want. I always say this about, well, I can't really say it now, much as I love Michael Caine, but Cider House Rules, I guess I'd say, woo. But for the most part, you could say that about Caine. You could say he made some stinkers, but he was always giving it his all.
Yeah.
And same thing with Lee. He never wavered in the gusto that he gave to a performance. But he ran the gamut. I mean, he'd have to with the number of films that he did. So the Hammer stuff, and we'll get to that because he not only played Dracula, which is most iconic, and no matter how many times they tried killing him off, he came back for another story. That character was so popular. He also played Frankenstein's monster.
The first one, yeah.
He also played, he was a mummy as well,
right?
He was
in Karras, actually.
Yeah.
It's just a remake of the Universal mummy series that Lon Chaney Jr. But he is far, even though it's not a speaking role, again, he's 6'5".
Yeah.
He's an imposing figure.
Yeah.
It really works. And of course, they also make Cushing's character, he's got a limp. I think, is it a trick knee, or he's been injured, so that he can't just run away from the mummy is jokingly, a lot of people always say, oh, let's just quickly walk away.
Let's just run.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and now we start getting into just not only him being an icon, but the iconic characters that he played. He not only did he play Sherlock Holmes, and I'm going to say more than once. I think he played Sherlock Holmes and Patrick McNee, John Steed, one of my heroes, played Watson. I'm pretty sure. Not only that, but he also played Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock's older brother, in a well-known, for Sherlock Holmes fans, a well-known Holmes film, but a little-known kind of a cult film for the rest of the world called The Secret Life of Sherlock Holmes. I think that's what it's called, by Billy Wilder. Very odd Sherlock Holmes tale. I forget the actor that played Holmes in it, but it also, it was an odd Sherlock Holmes story. It was done by Billy Wilder, but it also was one of those movies that for the longest time there were two or three different cuts floating around out there, and I think it got taken out of Wilder's hands, etc. And as long as we're on the subject...
That's the private life of Sherlock Holmes.
The private life of Sherlock Holmes. As long as we're on the subject, and I want to remind the fans that are in awe of what we do, episode in and episode out, we're doing this without a net. I'm not looking at the internet. This is all the essence of the gist of the show, which is the reams of useless information we have at our fingertips.
I'm totally looking at the internet.
But you're looking at the internet. But while we're on the subject of odd cuts and missing scenes and director's cuts and different cuts of things, and we're talking about Christopher Lee, we have to talk about The Wicker Man.
Oh, what a brilliant film. Yeah. Not from, the Nicolas Cage version, but the original.
Not the Nicolas Cage version, but it went from a movie that was barely seen. I think it was well reviewed, but not very well seen. And then when it disappeared, it really disappeared. So that I think the actual most... There's a famous story, and I'm going to get this completely wrong, but a famous story that Lee always told about the actual most complete cut, director's cut of the film, was found like in a container holding up the M1 freeway or something. it was a story like that. It was like this bizarre... someone's shed or their barn or something, they found this thing. But Wicker Man is... I have always appreciated Wicker Man, The Wicker Man. I've always liked it. I do not hold it in the esteem that a lot of horror fans do. But if anybody out there knows the title but has never seen it, I recommend watching it at least once. It is, and try not to read anything about it before you do.
You know what's funny about that movie is my discovery of it was, and this is a strange thing, is, you know, I got, as a teenager, I got drunk at a friend's house and, you know, you crash over.
Sure.
And the next morning, the dad kind of served us coffee and
nice.
Said, "Hey, you ever seen The Wicker Man?"
No.
And I was like, no, it's a friend of mine that I grew up with. His dad was always into Tom Baker, Doctor Who, and Tarzan.
Oh, cool.
Stuff
okay.
like that. Like, he, you know, he hit me up for Tarzan cartoons not too long ago.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
You know, he's not much of a geek, but he liked what he liked. And we watched The Wicker Man at his place.
No
and
way.
And that was such a weird...
Including the Britt Eklund stuff?
You know what? It's been so long. I think so. I don't know if he taped it off TV or where he got it, but he was just such a fan of the film.
And it is a very strange... horror film. It is a very unique horror film. It's a true one-off. I think it was a book.
Yeah.
Before it was a film.
I think so. You know what's funny is last week I was at a friend's house and we were discussing Lee's outfit in it. That
right,
kind
turtleneck.
Of, that yellow turtleneck and that kind of
blazer?
Checkered blazer. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's called Lord Summer Isle. Is that what his name is, the character?
Yeah, I think you're Somerville? Summer Isle?
I want to say Summer Isle. And... Yeah. You know, Lee was good at, he had that unbelievable voice, that incredible voice that he could do whatever he liked. But he could be in your face menacing, or he could be, you know, quietly brooding. And Lord Summer Isle was one of the latter characters that he didn't do much for the most part until the lid gets blown off the story. And you realize what this is all about, and he was just terrifying. Now the other end of the spectrum too, and we haven't scratched the surface yet of all the iconic characters and films.
And we probably won't.
No, but then he something happened in like the mid to late 70s where the comedy world started to kind of embrace a lot of the irony in Lee's performances and how iconic. And I think the first thing I can think of that really embraced that was him hosting Saturday Night Live in the mid 70s.
I was going to think that the Three Musketeers movies.
Oh, right.
Where he played Rochefort. I think he.
Yeah.
That's when it started to turn around a little bit for him. Because those are fun movies.
Oh, those are great. Those are Richard Lester.
Yeah.
Did those.
Then he started doing. Like he never. There's no real steady path. He's in airport disaster movies. He's in cheap Canadian sci-fi movies like Starship Invasions,
Marvel TV movies.
Yeah, he's so outclasses everything in the Captain America movie. Like,
oh God,
you know what's he doing in there?
Did he do a Muppet Show?
I don't know.
I feel like he did a Muppet Show, but I could be wrong. Now back to the horror thing and all the stuff that he did. He co-starred with good pal Peter Cushing, who was older than Lee. So if Lee died at 93, if Cushing were alive today, I want to say Cushing would have been like, you know, 110. I think he was a good 15, 20 years older than him, I think.
I think the thing with Cushing, though, is he died younger than he should have because his wife passed away.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot is said about Cushing is that he just started to kind of
deteriorate. He was supposed to have been the gentleman's gentleman.
Yeah.
Like one of the sweetest human beings. But he and Lee were good pals. Not just the movies that they did together, but they were good.
Yeah, they were. In fact, I bought Cushing's autobiography years ago, and I read it, and I remember thinking, like, you know, most when you got an autobiography, usually it was like, it was page after page of that guy's a bastard, and I hate this guy, and of course Cushing's was far from that, and of course with regards to Christopher Lee, he just loved him. You know, it was just nothing but love on Cushing's end, and I assume it's all reciprocal.
Yeah. So they were good pals. They worked a lot together. And, of course, Cushing ends up, you know, we didn't really get it or appreciate it probably as kids at the time, but Cushing ends up as, you know, Grand Moff Tarkin in Star Wars. But thinking about it now, I'd imagine that, you know, the sci-fi audience that was there in the mid to late 70s that was ready for Star Wars. In other words, the sci-fi audience that was actually clued into Star Wars, that actually was aware that George Lucas was working on this big space fantasy thing and that was going to be the answer to a lot of prayers. Those geeks, I can imagine now how crazy they must have gotten when they heard that Peter Cushing was going to be in this thing.
Yeah, it seems like it was a purposeful thing.
Oh yeah, oh totally.
Have you ever seen, speaking of Star Wars and Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, have you ever seen the movie Arabian Adventure?
Arabian Adventure?
Yeah.
I don't think so. What year?
It's 79.
Okay.
It's Lee is the let's say the Darth Vader of the film, Caliph Al-Quazar, and it's a big special effects kind of Star Wars-y story, like, you know, the prince and the princess, and it's been a long time since I've seen it, but it's got a lot of special effects. Cushing's in it, Emma Sams is in it, Mickey Rooney's in it, John Ratzenberger's in it.
What a cast. Wait,
John Ratzenberg is Ahmed, and your favorite actor in the world, Shane Rimmer, is Abu.
Oh, bless him, Shane.
The two whitest guys I can think of.
And one of the most unfortunate names in acting history.
But it's sort of like they they wanted to do a Star Wars-type story, but they set it in Arabian Nights times.
And wow, I don't think I've ever heard this thing.
You know what? It came on TV once in the 80s, and I remember going, what is this? And I watched the whole thing.
Speaking of the 80s and Lee, here's another one that is a real oddball one. It's a movie from 1980 called Serial.
Serial.
Martin Mull, Tuesday Weld. Ring any bells?
No.
It is 1980. It is I want to say Los Angeles. Based on a novel in the mid or late 70s, and it was Marin County, the trendy Marin County, during a year in the late 70s. Every kind of late 70s yoga-esque granola, you know, religious cults, ashrams, you name it, it's all kind of spoofed in this movie. And Martin Mull is the suburban dad in the middle of it trying to...
Has he ever played anything else?
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. And then there's a bit in it, I think. I'm trying to look at this right now on Wikipedia. There's a bit in it where Christopher Lee shows up as a guy called Luckman. And by the end of he I think is the leader of this cult. It's a comedy, by the way.
Yeah, I kind of got that.
Yeah, and he's the leader of this cult. But things start to change throughout, and by the end of it, he's joined like a gay motorcycle gang. And so by the end of it, Christopher Lee is riding a motorcycle up the stairs inside someone's house, and he's all in leather, but he's being a little camp as well, because he's this gay biker, And you just, I remember seeing it as a kid. It was on TV once, and I went, oh my God, that's Christopher Lee. Because that was right after 1941.
Yeah.
He was a Nazi in 1941, and he played that, you know, for laughs. Wasn't there a Dracula joke in that, too?
You know what? I've never sat through all of 1941.
Oh, really?
I've tried. I have a friend who swears by it. Like, it's one of his favorite movies of all time. But
it's tough, but yeah. I'm
not the biggest Spielberg guy, to be honest with you. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you know, by the way, do you know that Sally Field had to audition for Lincoln?
No way.
Now, I'm not the world's biggest Sally Field fan, but really?
Yeah.
She had to audition to play Lincoln's wife. What's wrong with this picture here?
I have no idea.
Anyway, so that's just an example of some of the stranger stuff that...
Actually, speaking of strange, have you ever seen The Return of Captain Invincible?
Yes!
Oh, you have?
Alan Arkin, right?
Alan Arkin. Lee's the bad guy in that.
Yeah, but you know
Mr.
what's funny?
Midnight.
It's so funny that you say this. Just yesterday, which would have been the 12th of June, I think. Today's what? What's today? 13th?
It's the whatever? 15th.
15th. Jeez. I've been in cryogenic sleep for the past 3 days, clearly. Just yesterday, driving around, happened to have NPR on, and someone's doing a little tribute to Christopher Lee. And, you know, of course, somebody has to, you know, make a little wink. And they go, well, you know, he did this and he did that and he played Dracula. But did you know that he was also in The Return of Captain Invincible? And it's they're wrapping up the show, you know, at this point. And when the guy, the host said The Return of Captain Invincible, of course, the audio cue was the song that he sings. Doesn't he have he's got at least one song, right?
All I remember about that movie is there's a song called Bullshit, where a guy just says it 100 times in a row.
The Return of Captain Invincible, right?
Yeah, it's a weird film. Yeah. I'm sure it has its supporters.
No, it's odd. It's weird.
It's a parody of superheroes. Alan Arkin is like a washed-up superhero.
Yes.
And he's a retired and an alcoholic. And I honestly...
83. Australian. It was Australian.
It was Australian, and I know it has its but it's almost like somebody went, that Rocky Horror, it's bringing in a lot of money.
Yeah, we got to do something.
We can make that too. And
wow, Alan Arkin, Christopher Lee. You know what's funny? I'm looking at Wikipedia. I am now getting on the internet because I want to look this movie up. Richard O'Brien. You're right. Richard O'Brien was the lyricist.
Yeah.
No, did you know this?
No, you know what? I didn't know that. But
he and
just
Richard Hartley
certain...
did Rocky Horror. They contributed three songs.
Yeah. So that's what they were kind of trying to create. It was a midnight movie, I guess.
Apparently, yeah. That's so funny. And you didn't know that. You had no clue.
No, I didn't. Like I said, I haven't seen that movie since the 90s. When superhero movies weren't exactly easy to find.
Right.
You went where the work was.
I mean, I remember opening weekend of Condor Man.
I missed opening weekend of Condor Man, and then there was no second weekend, so I was screwed.
We were so hungry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I remember Condor Man, and what was the one we talked about a month ago that I told you? It was so bad. I wanted to go see it so badly. My dad took me. My dad, sitting next to me, looking at me with his hand over his mouth, chuckling. He's laughing at the patheticness. And he feels bad for me, but he's also making fun of the look on my face, which must have been rip-off.
Oh, wasn't that like Sheena or something?
No, it was like A Shape of Things to Come or something.
Oh, yeah, Shape of Things to Come. Yeah, but that was sci-fi. You just had to wait another week in the late 70s.
That's right. That's true.
And,
all right. So here's what I got so far for action figures. Back to this little poll we're taking.
Yeah.
I got Scaramanga, Space 1999, Lord of the Rings / Hobbit, Dracula Product Enterprise, Dooku Star Wars. Was there a Frankenstein done of him? Did that?
A licensed one. My pal
someone did it because that's why does that look familiar to me?
Martin my friend Martin at Distinctive Dummies, who does these little runs of things, did an 8-inch Mego one. He may have done a 12-inch one, too. But those are long gone. I'm very proud to own one, and not to brag, but it's magnificent.
Well, you are bragging.
That was a little bit of a brag, yeah.
It's a mini brag. But yeah. Now here's the cool thing that starts to happen with Lee in the 80s, 90s till his passing. All the young pups that were growing up on his stuff are now in positions where they can put him in things and say thank you. Starting, I think, with Joe Dante putting him in Gremlins 2. As a bad guy, the mad scientist in Gremlins 2,
Dr. Cavender,
very underrated sequel, by the way.
And then he is it's funny you say that. Mm. He's in that, and then he's also like in The Howling 2.
Yes, he shows up in a lot of horror stuff by younger fellas.
Police Academy.
Mission most significantly, I think. Tim Burton, who's a massive, love him or hate him, he's a massive fan of the Hammer horror stuff. He grabs a hold of Christopher Lee, and I think Sleepy Hollow is the first time he used Lee.
It's surprising that is the first time he used Lee.
I think it was, which was 99.
Yeah.
I think that was the first time. But I know he showed up in Willy Wonka, in Dark Shadows. He did voiceover work in The Corpse Bride.
He was also the voice of the Jabberwocky in, what is that, Alice in Wonderland?
Yes, you're right.
That was just on TV last night. So
he did a good 6 or 7 Burton films. Peter Jackson, of course, takes him and puts him in the Lord of the Rings stuff. He also did, you're going to know more about this than I do, but he did a heavy metal album.
Yeah, I don't actually have those, but...
I've heard tracks.
He was a metal fan, and I think that's really super cool. He was, of course, also an opera singer, which is, just crazy. It makes you... after reading his accomplishments, I don't know about you, but I was like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah, like I'm sitting on my ass doing a podcast.
Well, I wasn't speaking specifically to this, but...
Right, sorry, didn't mean to bring the room down, but yeah what are you doing? No, he did an awful lot. He never stopped moving. He never stopped working. I don't know about his family life. Was he married to the same woman for like 70 years? Or
yeah, he was
one of those folks.
He was a long time married. There's
kids,
I believe so. Yes, and what really drives me crazy is at the end of a Chiller Theater Con, I used to stay till the lights went out. I remember the guy saying, "Next year's guest will be Christopher Lee." And I was like, oh, I'm saving my money. I got to meet Christopher Lee.
Sure.
And, of course, he didn't happen. And I think at the end of that one, they said, next year's guest will be Christopher Lee. And I remember, going nuts thinking, this isn't going to happen. I don't think he made a ton of appearances.
And I don't think so either.
From what I understand, he wasn't big on signing things.
Interesting. That's interesting.
A friend of mine told me once that... his agent got involved or something. I can't remember the whole story. A friend of mine's kind of in the industry, and these special effects guys, they're all horror fans, so they all end up talking. And there was something to the point of he wasn't thrilled about the fact that people were profiting heavily off of signed merchandise.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, but I could be completely wrong, and that's just secondhand information. So.
But you did get the sense from him. I may have gone down this road earlier and then lost track of it. But you did get a sense, I did anyway, that he, was a bit of a fanboy himself. He loved the Tolkien stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He was well aware of the history of the Dracula character. He took this shit very seriously.
Well, and he also would, narrate documentaries on the subject. And the other thing I liked about him was... there's the famous story with the Hammer films where he clearly was not happy with the Dracula sequels. And in fact, one of them, he doesn't speak because he wouldn't speak the dialogue.
That's right.
And there was one story I watched on a documentary about Hammer right from his mouth that basically said, was it that Fantastic Hammer Films book? I can't remember, but it was basically, I don't want to do this Dracula movie. Well, Chris, we're going to have to fire a lot of people here if you want to do it. And he did fine, you know, and it really was, speaking to his character, was the kind of guy he was.
Well, know? Speaking of, there was, I want to say, you know, your good buddy, Forry Ackerman. for those paying attention, Brian Hyler and I, while we were fans of Famous Monsters, and we picked it up as youngsters, I think I can speak for both of us that we didn't love Famous Monsters.
I came to it after Starlog.
Yeah, Starlog was more my bag than Famous Monsters.
I mean, if I had run into Famous Monsters when I was prior to Starlog, I think the story would be different.
Well, you'd looking back, especially. I mean, I kind of got it at the time, but looking back, especially all these years later, and you know, whipping open a copy of Famous Monsters, it wasn't exactly you know the Wall Street Journal. I mean, it wasn't, Starlog went deep. You know, Cine Fantastique went very deep.
Yep.
Into this stuff.
And I'm also not going to say that one, you know, if without Famous Monsters, I don't think there would be a Starlog. But it's just I'm a product of my era. So
yeah, and Famous Monsters is very tongue in cheek. It is not heavy on the facts. You got the sense for a long while that the studio would provide for you with publicity shots, and then he had to kind of make up the rest, you know. And, you know, they tell him who was in the shot or what the movie was about, but then he had to go.
You know, by the time we were in the late 70s with that magazine too, like mid to late 70s, the whole world had changed. Monsters weren't as in vogue as science fiction, you know. And you have,
yes.
I got a copy right beside me that has R2-D2 on it.
No, you're right. He had to catch up very quickly.
Yeah,
with the Starlogs and the fantastic films and all those things with the sci-fi world, and he quickly. Well, I think one of the first things he did was latch on to the cantina and Chewbacca and the creature and alien aspect of Star Wars and put those guys on the cover, you know, to kind of make an excuse. Yeah. But no, he had to keep up. But there was some, I think there was a famous story where he really pissed Christopher Lee off.
Oh, I don't know that one. I do know a rumor that... Ackerman, and this is believable, if Ackerman was going to be at a party, Boris Karloff would sometimes not show up because, but you know, Karloff was a really, really gentlemanly sort and probably didn't love all the attention. You know what I mean? Like
there was something that Ackerman did. He crossed the line with Lee, I think. And I think it was Lee, and he published Lee's address or something, or there was a basically, I think what Ackerman did was deflect, and it was something to do with fandom or autographs or something, and he crossed the line, I think, and I think he published Lee's address or his agent's address or I don't know what. To say, you know, well, here, if you want to get in touch with him directly and tell him how much you love this and that, or you'd love him to do this and that, and he had the fans kind of take up the mantle, and Lee was pissed.
You know what? That sounds really familiar.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
I think that's what happened.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there was something where he got something published.
Yeah, and Lee was not happy. Like, Lee played the game for a bit, and he started to understand the value of a Forry and Famous Monsters and fandom. This is, you know,
that magazine rose to prominence right around the time that the Hammer films were really coming out. So they
and also getting their second wind.
Yeah, right.
Like it was the TV reruns. Famous Monsters, you know, got its second wind with those movies, with all the reruns, the Saturday afternoon stuff, and
yeah.
Did you have Horror Incorporated? Did you have that on like Friday nights?
You know, we didn't. We kind of got the shaft in that regard. I didn't have any horror host as a kid.
I always thought that Lee, you know, being a huge Twilight Zone fan that I am, I always thought that he would have been a guy that would have been a face that would have, you know, because a lot of Brits showed up in the five seasons of Twilight Zone. He did show up in, I could be getting this wrong, but, you know, one of those other anthology shows, like One Step Beyond or...
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Yeah. I don't think it was even called One Step Beyond, but one of the very earliest things he did was playing a Nazi character in one of those anthology series that only lasted like a season. But it wasn't Outer Limits and it wasn't Twilight Zone.
I think it is One Step Beyond.
Is it One Step Beyond?
Yeah. Wilhelm Reitlinger, which is a very Nazi type.
What else would we be doing with this information if we didn't have a podcast and if Christopher Lee hadn't died?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I would have still done this episode, but probably more done. I didn't think he'd ever die, to be honest with you.
Truly, it's true. Yeah. The sad thing is, God, there's dozens of actors we could be doing a show like this on. That's the weird thing.
Oh, yeah, like, we still have to get a Roddy McDowell out there. We got a bunch.
I thought we did a Roddy McDowell. We didn't?
Did we do a Roddy McDowell?
No, we didn't. No, you're right. We didn't. You know what we did? We did an Apes episode.
Right.
And
right.
Spent 30 minutes talking about Roddy McDowell and his career and how much we love Roddy McDowell.
And just for those that are listening and they're going, where's the second part to your Apes episode? We never do anything in a row.
We do them backwards like the prequels.
Yeah, yeah. We like to circle back, as they say.
Yeah. Like keeping you on your toes.
Now, I want to just go through a few different titles and get your reaction if you've seen them. Neat things he's done. Horror yeah. Express.
Was that like a train thing
yes.
or something?
Yes, and in fact, it's probably airing right now, and I forgot to tape it because today was a Christopher
Lee. Was it a Hammer Horror?
Christopher Lee tribute on TCM. Glad I remembered it. And by the way, I've been sick all day, so I could have actually watched it.
Wait a minute. There's a TCM tribute to Lee going on tonight?
Yes, I believe so.
What am I doing a podcast with you?
I don't know. I was sick all day, and I was talking to you.
I'm going to say that I have not seen it.
Okay. Oh, that's an underrated classic, and you should see it. It used to be one of those things
called?
That Horror Express.
Horror Express. Yeah, I'm writing
it down.
The
video store you walked into had a copy of it with a different color cover than the other video store back in the 80s, but it is quite a good film.
Got it.
Let's see. Starship Invasions you haven't seen.
I have seen that.
Oh, you have.
You gave me a copy of it, right?
I don't think
is that
I
the Italian one with like Richard Kiel is in it, I think, and
No.
Who else is in it besides Lee?
Robert Vaughn.
In the big the weird headgear?
Yeah, Robert Vaughn's in it.
Right, and Lee's wearing that crazy headgear.
Yeah, with the dragon suit, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Oh, you have, yeah. That's a Canadian classic.
A camp classic.
I'm just trying to think here. I forget that he played Fu Manchu.
Attack of the Clones?
I haven't seen that.
He did play Fu Manchu.
Played him
That's back when a British or American person could play an Asian American.
So convincingly.
And not get in trouble for it.
Yeah, now Castle of Fu Manchu...
He was no Mickey Rooney, though.
No. Castle of Fu Manchu is my favorite. Or Boris Karloff.
Another
great...
Peter Sellers.
Oh, yes.
In Murder by Death, which is a brilliant comedy if no one's seen it.
Castle of Fu Manchu is famous because I think that's so inept, it's on Mystery Science Theater.
And this is Lee?
Yeah. And they
admit he made maybe some bad choices, but did he do a lot of schlock? You know, like the Starship Invasions thing. That's schlock. Did he do a lot of stuff like that, or was that the exception?
I think he just went where the work was.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
I don't think that's.
What else? Give me another title. Throw me something else.
Oh, I'm just trying to. It's just amazing to go through all these.
How about any features that you can think of that he turned down, that he almost was this character, but any of that spring to mind?
I don't know. Here's one that I thought would be fun, though. You must have seen The Magic Christian.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
1969. This is how crazy this pedigree was. 1969, the stars are Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr, okay? The screenplay is by John Cleese and Graham Chapman just before Monty Python takes off, because they were writing partners, and they had been on several shows and written for, you know, Doctor in the House and things like that. And the opening credits, the music is by Badfinger. In fact, the album, the first album they put out was called Magic Christian Music by Badfinger. The opening song, the opening titles is Come and Get It, which was written by a fella called Paul McCartney and performed by Badfinger, who were originally called the Ivies. When the Beatles set up their Apple label, they started looking for bands and singers and so on. Badfinger are one of the greatest. They were a fantastic group, incredible singer-songwriter, and Pete Ham, and one of the saddest stories in rock music ever. I'm totally sidetracking here, but when you talk about Magic Christian, this is where it hits me, because never in history, this was the only time in history that a band basically were ushered in by the Beatles, the greatest group of all time and the biggest thing in the world, especially at the time. So much so that they were called the Ivies, and John Lennon renamed them Badfinger, because he had something called Badfinger Boogie that he always worked on. He called them Badfinger, and McCartney writes and produces the first song, which goes like to number one, basically. and then it was, but an incredible output. When you think about Badfinger, people go, "Oh, I don't think I know who they are." Well, you go, "If you want it anytime, come and get it." Okay, well, everybody knows that. Then you go, "What about No Matter What?" "No matter what you are." Oh, yeah. That was Badfinger. But most of all was Without You. "I can't live if living is without you." Everyone, first off, a whole generation of people think it's Mariah Carey. But for those people that know better, a whole generation before that thinks it's Harry Nilsson. It wasn't. Nilsson brought it, I think, took it to number one, and his is the most iconic. Yeah. But it was a Badfinger song. It was an album track by Badfinger. Yeah. We could do a whole episode just on Badfinger.
I wouldn't talk a lot.
So I'm sorry. I'm ranting. But yes, Christopher Lee. There's lots of weird cameos in Magic Christian. I think does Yul Brynner show up in it too?
Could be. I haven't actually seen it since I was like seven, so
it's a weird movie. Yeah,
it's one of those movies where I thought I would like it as a kid and didn't understand it. Now, do you remember, speaking of weird cameos, Jerry Lewis directed a film called One More Time where Christopher Lee shows up as Dracula, but Peter Cushing is also Dr. Frankenstein in a short cameo?
No, but I'm going to write this down right now.
Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford.
Wait. Wait a minute. That rings a bell. One more time. Lawford and Davis Jr.
Yeah.
That rings a bell, but I'm writing it down here. One more time.
Movie poster even is Jack Davis artwork.
Oh, that's right up my street.
Yeah. Looks terrible.
I'm pretty sure I've seen this because my buddy Wyatt Doyle, who you know because he's, bless him. Now I can't think of it.
I know who Wyatt is.
You know who he is, and he works with the brothers that you love.
Yeah, the Friedman brothers.
The Friedman brothers.
Yes.
He's a big Sammy fan. Has everything Sammy's ever done, you know, first on VHS, bootleg VHS, and then on DVD. I'm pretty sure I've seen that through him. But Lee was in that, playing Dracula?
Just an unbilled cameo, and Christopher, or Peter Cushing is Dr. Frankenstein.
Wow, okay.
Which I think is crazy, because it just shows how iconic they were in the 1960s.
Well, did you, in the 60s, you said?
Yeah. I think that's maybe 1970.
Because don't you feel that our childhoods, you know, the whole, you know, Godzilla on a Sunday afternoon kind of thing, and some of the Hammer horror stuff in the afternoons, you know, and so on. Don't you feel like that was a big part of our
Yeah. I used to watch Hammer films on Friday night. They'd be these kind of tomatoey prints on City TV.
Right,
and
right.
Give me nightmares.
Well, they truly were. I mean,
I remember several times mom coming in the room going, "What are you watching?" You know, it was graphic. There was graphic stuff in there for television.
Yeah, they were a bit gory. They were a bit scary. Mm-hmm. They were sexy.
They were sexy. There was a lot of cleavage in those, yep. In color.
Yep. I remember seeing The Vampire Lovers for my first time when I was 14 going, Hey
now.
Yeah. Surprisingly, I don't own a copy of that on like DVD or Blu-ray or anything, and it's a good film.
Speaking of iconic British, crazy British actors, Oliver Reed was it Werewolves of London?
Curse of the Werewolf.
Curse of the Werewolf.
Yeah.
Who did Werewolves of London? That's an iconic design of a werewolf.
Yeah, that's the first. That's Henry Hull. That's the first Universal Werewolf film.
Look at that.
Predates the Wolfman, actually. And that was mostly because Hull didn't really want a lot of makeup to obscure his face.
Right.
Which it happened again if you really in the Jack Nicholson Wolf movie. He didn't want to be all covered up.
And you know, it's got its moments, the Jack Nicholson Wolf movie.
It does. I kind of enjoy it.
It's got its moments.
Have you ever seen Jesse Franco's Count Dracula? Which is it's Lee playing Count.
That sounds familiar.
1970. It's probably the first movie to put the thing out of Stoker's book that, of course, Coppola did, where Dracula's an old man at the start, and then he gets younger.
I don't think I've seen it.
Klaus Kinski plays Renfield. Herbert Lahm is Van Helsing.
Well, there's a cast.
It is. It's a good cast.
There's a cast right there.
I seem to recall reading something about having some of them had to film without being in the same room due to timing.
Or just not wanting to be near Klaus Kinski?
Yeah, well, possibly.
Did you ever see that documentary? The what's his name? You know, German. It's called my beautiful fiend.
No,
my best fiend or my beautiful fiend. It's a documentary on the friendship between Werner Herzog and Klaus Kinski, and how insane Kinski was, and how he threatened to kill Herzog many times, and Herzog was going to kill himself if Kinski walked off his movie. And at a certain point, it's a bizarre. Very strange documentary. But,
Lee only wanted to do this because it was going to be faithful.
Okay.
And of course, they still made changes. And yeah, Lahm and Lee never saw each other during the filming. They shot all their scenes separately.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Did Lahm do a lot of horror pictures?
Well, he's Hammer's Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
But no, he wasn't. Heavy. I don't think he was heavily into horror.
Mm-hmm.
I think he, you know, obviously he moved into comedy later on in his life.
But he was he was a very serious. He was in a lot of great spy type pictures, and
he's really great in a movie called Asylum. It's an Amicus film, and one of these days we got to do a whole Amicus
episode. Thing, yeah.
Or and we should do a Hammer one too, but
we could do Hammer Amicus. We could do like a.
Well, I think there's too much to mine, to be honest with you.
That's weird. A lot of weird Amicus stuff. Did Amicus do the baby? Was that Amicus?
No, I don't think so.
Creeperama.
I think the baby was an American production, if I'm not mistaken.
What other podcast can you go from a Christopher Lee tribute to talking about the baby?
Yeah. Well, let's not.
Movies ever.
So we should probably wrap it up. I know we haven't done Lee justice, but...
Did he do The Simpsons?
He did not do The Simpsons.
He did not do The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I would have thought those guys would have been all over Christopher Lee showing up in their show.
Well, you never know. They may have been, and he just may have not wanted to do it, or time didn't work out. Who knows?
Right. You
know, sometimes they need to write the right thing, right? So...
I can't believe there's much that was left for Lee to accomplish. I mean, I think the crowning achievements for him that he was probably most proud of was playing. He loved
Conan Doyle in the Sherlock Holmes stories. He got to play Holmes. He got to play Mycroft. Of course, he became one of the, if not to a lot of people, the most iconic Dracula. But I think most of all was being involved in the Tolkien films.
Now,
you know,
will,
imagine him wanting to have done them, you know, for 40 some years, and then someone finally coming along with the technology and wanting him to be part of it.
Now, one of the rumors I have heard is he was mentioned in that, and I could be wrong, but I swear I heard it. It was either him or Vincent Price were mentioned. Remember Tom Baker was trying to get a Doctor Who movie made?
Doctor Who meets Scratchman.
Yeah, and I thought he was one of the choices.
Weren't he and Ian Martyr writing it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, it's something I wish had been made.
Yeah, because you know it would have been a
odd
massive
film.
Train wreck.
Yeah, but it would be a train wreck I pop, like, you know, like I do with At the Earth's Core or those kind of films. I pop in once a year and just love.
Lee, you could see in an alternate sort of universe. You know, did you ever see Casino Royale?
No.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Not all of it.
No, I mean the...
The Woody Allen one.
The Woody Allen, you know, the John Huston, Orson Welles. Did you ever see that?
Not soberly.
No, yeah. No, it's got some moments, but it's a huge, incredible mess of a movie. But you just said something. You said train wreck, scratch man. Oh, you know, the funny sort of wink to those in the know, David Niven is in it. There are like three different characters, actors that play James Bond, including Woody Allen playing Jimmy Bond, who's James Bond's nephew. Peter Sellers plays a character called James Bond. But you get the sense that David Niven's character is the real deal. That you know, Woody Allen, Jimmy Bond is his American nephew. I mean, it's a mess. It doesn't matter because none of it makes sense. But the wink to the audience sort of is that when the first, you know, when Dr. No was going to happen, David Niven was one of the names tossed around. In fact, by Fleming, you know, David Niven would have been one of the people that Ian Fleming would have wanted to play James Bond. So when you're watching Casino Royale and you see him in action, you kind of go, so that in an alternate universe, he might have played Bond in 1962. He could have been, you know, Sean Connery for four or five pictures. I look at Lee and I think about all the stuff that he did and the universes that he kind of traveled in and the genres. You could see if they ever could have gotten a big budget Doctor Who off the ground, maybe, and they wanted to go in a different direction. Do you think he would have been an interesting choice as the Doctor? In the 70s.
I think he could have totally pulled it off. I don't know if anyone would have given him the chance. Because he was so put him in villains. And he was good at villains.
Right.
You know, it's one of those things where I would have liked to have seen him. Like, Cushing got to play the good guy, bad guy.
Yeah,
Lee, not so much.
No, you're right. You're right. It probably wasn't until... Well, I mean, even Saruman, for crying out loud, he's good for a while.
Yeah.
You know, because did you see any of The Hobbits?
Not The Hobbits. I saw the
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah.
Because in The Hobbits, he's pretty much all good. Because those take place, you know, 70 years before.
Oh, okay.
Lord of the Rings. Then Lord of the Rings, he becomes a baddie. But I could see him. Because, you know, just recently...
He'd have been a cool Doctor Who.
Well, there was a clip just recently celebrating that we're coming up with the 10th anniversary of Doctor Who coming back to television.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. You know, the Eccleston, Russell T. Davis, Billy Piper Doctor Who.
Which and makes sense.
There's a great clip of Peter Capaldi... talking about his, it's like a minute thing, his memories of the show coming back and the moment he heard Eccleston was going to be the guy and then the moment he saw him on screen and especially Billy Piper. But just watching him talk and the passion that Capaldi speaks with, it kind of hit me like, God, when is it coming back? Like, yeah. I can't wait to see what else he's going to do with the character. And it struck me, I think, more because we've missed him for a while now, just how great Capaldi looks. You know, he's one of those guys that just, you know, you thought, well, he probably would have been a character actor. You never thought he'd necessarily be a leading man because he's got such interesting features. But that's what I loved about Eccleston. That's what I loved about Matt Smith, Tom Baker, Sylvester McCoy to a degree, Pertwee. They all had these unusual features that made them
distinct.
The Doctor, distinctive. You know, nothing against David Tennant and nothing against Peter Davison, you know, but they're not my go-to guys as the Doctor because they're so cute. You know, he's more, when I think of the Doctor, it's more distinctive. Hmm. And Lee, of course, had that in spades.
Oh, absolutely.
So he would have been a dynamite Doctor, I think.
He would have probably bonked his head as he walked in and out of the TARDIS, though.
Yes, you would have been a lot of ducking.
We're the same height, so that I can relate.
So there you go. This was a last-minute episode choice. It's all down to Hyler. It was his choice to do this, but I think we pulled it off. I think we knew enough about Lee. You could do this all by yourself.
I'm a humongous fan and have been for a long time. So
yeah,
there's pictures of Lee all over my house, most notably in my bathroom. Oh.
Really?
Yeah, where we have a wall of postcards from movies.
Aww.
There's a lot of Christopher Lee on there.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So, well, a lot of Betty Page too.
Rest in peace, Christopher Lee. Scaramanga, Saruman, Dracula, Captain Klink. What was he called in Space 1999?
Captain Xantor.
Captain Xantor, Frankenstein.
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, Lord Summerisle, Mycroft Holmes.
Karras.
Karras.
The list never ends.
The list never ends. So what a great episode. I enjoyed it. I hope you did. And if Lee is listening somewhere, I hope he did too. I hope we did him justice.
Yeah, we'll never see your like again, sir.
No, we won't.
So
we really...
that's it for us. We'll see you back here in July where we'll have a new topic. I don't know what that is yet.
Well, we'll probably have a lot of post-Comic-Con madness to talk about, I would think.
Well, you will. I will have stories of mowing my lawn and going to flea markets that weekend.
I'll be sending you pictures. Maybe there's some surprises popping up here and there.
Be interesting.
And you never know what I might find for you. You're always looking
get
for crap.
Get me something nice.
I'll get you something nice.
All right.
I know your size.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.